Welcome to the Jurisdictions Podcast. In this episode, Eduardo Silva de Freitas, PhD candidate at Erasmus University Rotterdam and junior researcher in private international law here at the TMC Asset Institute, is joined by Dr. Georgia Antonopoulou, assistant professor in commercial dispute resolution at the Law School of the University of Birmingham, and Professor Christine Schwebel-Patel, co-director of the Center for Critical Legal Studies at the Law School of the University of Warwick, to hear more about the marketing of courts and global justice. Eduardo.
Today, we will be discussing a rather provocative topic. What if courts, like products and services, could be marketed as something to be bought and sold? This is a topic which both of today's guests have explored in great depth. Dr. Georgia Antonopoulou, in an open access article titled Forum Marketing in International Commercial Courts, and Professor Christine Schwebel-Patel, in a book titled Marketing Global Justice, The Political Economy of International Criminal Law. It is common to think of courts as separate from markets and businesses. But both Dr. Antonopoulou and Professor Schwebel-Patel suggest that they are becoming intertwined. Georgia and Christine, thank you for joining us today. Georgia, in your work, you introduced the idea of forum marketing in international commercial courts. What are international commercial courts, and what do you mean when you say that they engage in forum marketing?
So international commercial courts are relatively recently established courts. They are called international, but they are not international in the sense that they are created by a treaty or under an international organization. So unlike the International Criminal Court, for example, which is the focus of Professor Schwebel-Patel's book, I focus on national courts. There are national courts created by states, by different countries, and they are international. They are called international because they deal with cross-border commercial disputes. There are many different international commercial courts, so it's a bit difficult to study them as a unit. There are similarities, but also striking differences. But just to mention a few examples, we find these courts in Europe. We have the Netherlands Commercial Court, the Chambers for International Commercial Disputes in Germany, for example, in Hamburg, in Frankfurt, in Stuttgart, Mannheim. Then we have the Paris Commercial Court. And we also find them in the Middle East and in Singapore and China. For example, the Dubai International Financial Center Courts, the Qatar International Court, the Abu Dhabi Global Market Courts, and the Astana International Financial Center Court. So we see that these courts are established in special economic zones in the Middle East, which means that they are part of broader policies to attract foreign direct investment. There are many courts. The list is growing. We see that last year in 2024, also Bahrain created a Bahrain International Commercial Court. So it's nice. I never get bored. So I see more and more courts being established. These courts are described in the literature and they are talked about as very innovative courts. And just to mention a few examples, they use English as the language of court proceedings. They appoint foreign judges to their bench. So although the Singapore International Commercial Court is a national court of Singapore, it has foreign judges sitting on its bench. And they very much try to also copy arbitration because they compete with arbitration. So they try to emulate its features in an attempt to attract parties. We talk about commercial dispute resolution as a market, and we use that metaphor a lot. There are many different courts, countries, well, not all countries, but some countries compete to attract litigants. We also have arbitral institutions competing with each other. We also have ADR now, mediation, for example, being on the rise. So we talk of commercial dispute resolution as a market. However, we usually focus on parties. How do parties choose among dispute resolution methods? What do they like? How do they choose the best option? So the discussion is always about the parties, forum shopping. How do they choose? How do they forum shop? And there is very little research on how and if, whether and if so, how courts respond to that competition. Do they actively participate in that competition? Do they actively try to attract cases? And there's very little research on that. And this is research I used in my article, The Literature on Forum Selling. So there's some research saying that some courts, for specific reasons, under specific conditions, they are not just theatrical spectators to this ongoing forum shopping, but they participate in the market. They try to attract litigants by adopting various techniques, speeding up trials, favoring claimants because the claimant chooses the court and so on. But that's, I think, where research stops. So we mainly focus on forum shopping, and there is some research, for example, by Clermann, Bechtold, Frankenreiter, who say, well, some courts participate in that market and try actively to attract cases. How they do that, they engage in this practice of forum selling. In my research, I say, well, international commercial courts, they also try to attract cases, and they do that by going beyond and above forum selling by engaging in marketing. And what explains that is that they are new courts. They need to raise awareness of their recent establishment. Most people don't even know of these courts. You might never have heard of them. They don't have a lot of cases yet. Well, depends on the court, but generally speaking, they had a very slow takeoff, and they base their jurisdiction on choice of court agreements. So this is another very important explanation for marketing. The cases do not come to them automatically on the basis of a law. The law says that parties have to choose these courts. And because they rely on parties' choice, they are very reputation sensitive. They have to cultivate a positive reputation, and that's why they market themselves. And then I explain and I discuss the different ways this marketing takes place, by using brand names, by appointing very well-known judges, usually drawn from England and Wales, but also arbitrators to their bench. So I claim that this, to some extent, is a practice of celebrity endorsement, as we see it in marketing. They engage in public relations. They try to have a very good relationship with the bar because it's lawyers that usually choose the court. It's not the parties, and we have research on that. So they engage in public relations, and they also use procedure as a signal. So sometimes they use the right buzzwords. They say, oh, we are common law courts, even though they might not be with regard to all parts of the proceedings, because they know that parties like common law procedure, and foreign businesses are more familiar with common law civil proceedings than with civil law procedure. Or they say they will develop a lex mercatoria, but God knows what that means. I think it's more of a buzzword, trying to show to parties that they are familiar with business practices and international commerce. So by marketing, I mean how these courts try to cultivate a positive reputation and acquire a caseload by promoting their innovations and gaining and engaging with court users.
Continuing with the idea of marketing, a controversial notion in the context of courts, but now moving to a rather different context. Christine, your work focuses on this idea of marketing global justice by the International Criminal Court. Can you tell us what marketing means in that context? Who is marketing what and to who?
Yeah, thanks, Eduardo. Thank you for having me. And thank you for putting me in conversation with Georgia, whose work is really excellent. And I think there are lots of overlaps in what we're trying to diagnose about law and market economies. So you say that it's controversial to put courts in the context of the market and marketing. And on the one hand, I would say there's an aspect of it that's not controversial, right? Courts exist in a particular historical material context. That means that they require resources, they, you know, have to hire staff, they need buildings, and so on. So in that sense, part of the work is really just to foreground that and to say, courts exist, all courts exist in a particular historical material context, which will have an effect on how they're run and also at the end of the day, the judgments. The part that is controversial is to say that the way in which courts act in this historical material context is itself indicative of that context, right? And is reproducing that particular context. So I was looking at international criminal courts and tribunals, and particularly the International Criminal Court in The Hague, to look at how marketing is playing a really important role in sustaining the status quo. And I think that that's counterintuitive for anyone who first encounters questions of global justice, which are there to address injustices, including the disparities between the global north and the global south, for example, income inequalities, violence, and how that's distributed, and so on. So you'd think that a key function in the context of international criminal law and anti-impunity is to move towards, well, global justice. And what I found was that these tools of marketing, like branding and publicity and so on, were having an inherently political and at the same time depoliticizing effect. So one of the ways in which I looked at that was to look at how the International Criminal Court in particular was foregrounding a very particular victim stereotype, which serves the purposes of supporting the status quo. So the victim stereotype that was really produced and reproduced at the International Criminal Court from its early days was that of a gendered, racialized and classed victim, usually placed in the global south. So that was sort of the typical stereotype that was being produced, not just in the judgments, but also more holistically, looking at how the International Criminal Court functioned, its website and its, at that time, Twitter accounts and so on. So the reproduction of these stereotypes had the purpose, I argue, in the book, of attracting very particular patrons to support the functioning of the court. And that's the part that's controversial, certainly. And in a very simplistic way, and I think in a way that what George's work does as well, it's to look at the question of justice from a different perspective. And in terms of political economy, part of that is always to question who benefits materially and who loses. So what I was seeing at the International Criminal Court was that there are these cases, mostly against African perpetrators, which involved African victims. And it appeared to me to be reinforcing the strength of the idea that global justice is distributed from the global north, with The Hague playing a really, really important role in that.
There is a phrase in your book that I loved, and which says, "Celebrity humanitarianism is arguably the most glittering superficial manifestation of conceptions of justice and spectacle colliding or colluding." You also give examples of celebrities such as Angelina Jolie and the role of Amal Clooney, famously married to George Clooney, as a human rights lawyer. I wonder if these are the sorts of patrons that you mention in your book as benefiting from the global justice system as it's currently designed.
Yeah, so that takes me back to how I really started this project, because when I was doing an internship at the International Criminal Court about a million years ago, in its very early days, I was also at the same time reading Naomi Klein's No Logo, which is about the history of branding, in particular in the focusing on the 1990s. And looking at the question of what happens when image is more central than substance, to really make it in a very sort of crude formulation. And celebrity humanitarianism was something that grew at the same time, right? So if we think about the International Criminal Court existing in a particular historical material context, then it's important that the International Criminal Court was set up in the 1990s, while there was also this influx of big brands, brands going global, the idea of celebrities endorsing brands. And this appeared to increasingly, to me, to also be happening in terms of humanitarianism. Now, there was fantastic one, celebrity humanitarianism, that I drew on in the book. But it is the sort of the epitome of the image over substance, and really questioning who benefits. When a celebrity endorses a particular cause, then is it that their brand is further enhanced and that they gain, you know, more movie roles or better ad deals and whatever? Or is it really that the cause is highlighted? And I think empirically that might be difficult to test. But what we certainly know is that, again, this is about sort of the sustaining of the status quo, that it puts the celebrity in the foreground and does not tend to foreground the particular cause. So we can really put that into conversation of what I was saying about victims. Victims remain without agency. They remain in the background, and in the foreground is the celebrity.
Georgia, turning back now to the context of international commercial courts, what are some implications of these marketing practices?
First of all, when you try to make a court attractive to parties and their lawyers, and you try to build a positive reputation, you usually aim for familiarity. So there is this misconception out there that this court, or any court, because it's said that that's just a specific context, has tried to choose the most efficient proceedings or the better rules, so to say. But undertaking research on which rules are actually efficient and which work best and in what context, it's a very difficult research. It's very difficult for us to set side by side common law procedural rules and civil law procedure rules and figure out which one is worse or better. So marketing research, and that's where marketing research can be quite interesting, tells us that you have to offer something that parties are familiar with. And that's why we see that these courts usually opt for common law style proceedings. Of course, different courts do that more, others less. It's a matter of degree. But we see that also in their communications and in their marketing, they're emphasize a lot their common law style civil proceedings. And it's true, because you mentioned the courts in the Middle East, for example, adopting these common law proceedings was also a way to overcome foreign lawyers' distrust towards Middle Eastern or other Asian courts. And in that respect, there is great research by my colleague Willem Theus at the University of Leuven, but also Erpelding has done a lot of research on mixed courts of the colonial era, showing that they were dealing with disputes between foreigners abroad, and they were staffed with foreign judges applying foreign laws and the extraterritorial application of these laws, because the underlying belief was that the laws of these states are not good enough. So marketing, and this ties with what Christine mentioned, exploits and reinforces these stereotypes of good and bad procedure. But I think we have to understand that context is important. Different states have different needs, and common law proceedings might not be the best in every country, or not necessarily always the best. Then we see that in general, marketing reinforces these beliefs that, for example, party autonomy is what parties want. Parties want to design proceedings by their agreement, and this is good because this offers a better customer service. And that's another thing. So they view court users as customers, and they deserve a better customer service or even experience. And this is not only an idea, it also translates specifically into rules, into case law. We see, for example, that these courts are a bit reluctant to deny jurisdiction. And they say, oh, we do it because we want to promote access to justice, it's the party's right. So we see jurisdiction becoming from a state discretion into a state obligation. And underlying this approach to some extent, what explains this approach to some extent is this customer service attitude, or this attitude that we need to offer parties what they want. So party autonomy is really important. However, I think we should not uncritically reproduce the statements. How much party autonomy do we want? This is something we should discuss. Is it good placing procedure in the hands of the parties? Or if we do so, it's like, you know, putting the lunatics in charge of the asylum, to say so, yeah? So how much party autonomy is good? And this is something we should debate a bit more seriously, I think. So I think marketing has, and there is research on the performativity of marketing in marketing studies, has a performative function. It reproduces, it enacts the reality it purports to describe. The more we keep saying out there that party autonomy is the cardinal value in civil procedure, the more we start all believing in and sometimes uncritically reproducing it. But there is space for us to do research. And I think it influences academic discourse, the way we talk about these values, or, for example, always prioritizing efficiency over other values. So we see all these market values prevailing. So it produces and reinforces this pro-business approach, and sometimes it obscures other aspects. Courts are not just for the parties. They are for the people, for the general public. The idea that commercial disputes are inter-parties relationships and therefore they don't have broader implications is not entirely true. And the last thing, marketing also, we see in the communications of these courts that they always present their design, their choice for specific rules as a response to market preferences. This is what parties want, so this is what we will give them. But this sometimes silences the fact that, well, these courts were not just created for the parties. They also promote broader policy objectives, attracting foreign direct investment, creating a business-friendly climate. So they obscure the politics. And it's always, oh, we do that because that's what parties want. Well, not exclusively. So marketing sometimes throws the spotlight on specific approaches, specific procedural doctrines, and overshadows others or other types of litigants, other legal cultures and needs. So I think these are the main implications of marketing.
Still on the topic of implications, some of these can become contentious in the public debate. In this context, there was a proposal for setting up an international commercial court in Belgium, which was rejected. Can you say a few words about that?
Yes, I was really fond of studying this court. And every time I did, everyone was telling me, but why are you studying a non-existent court? And the answer, I think, is exactly that. Exactly because it never came to fruition. It eventually failed. It's interesting seeing why. So this was a proposal for the Brussels International Business Court, but then it never passed the parliament and the court was, in the end, never created. There were many objections to the Brussels International Business Court. Some of them have to do, for example, with language. Belgium is a country that uses French, Dutch, and German as the official languages. Using and adding one more language to that was complicated. But the main criticism, or one of the interesting points of criticism, was that this is a court for the rich. And it's a nice picture that I use in the opening page of my thesis, which I'm now transforming into a book. And I use it also in class when I discuss with students. It was from Belgian newspaper showing a very expensive yacht, which was symbolizing the Brussels International Business Court, and at the same time showing a very slow boat following it, which was symbolizing the Belgian justice system with all its slow proceedings and all these disadvantages it might have and all the problems it has. So the idea was that, you know, these are courts only for commercial disputes because they are more expensive than the rest of the courts within the country. They are only available to parties who can afford them. And if we create these courts, then maybe we disregard the rest of the civil justice system or we disregard consumer disputes. And we do see that indeed there is a tendency of courts keeping these big high-value cases while consumer disputes, family disputes sometimes are outsourced to private dispute resolution providers. That isn't negative in itself. I've also done research on that. But the focus of the civil justice system, I think, should not be just on a particular type of cases and a particular type of litigants. So there was this idea of creating this fear that the Brussels International Business Court would create a two-tier justice system. It would infuse and create inequality within civil justice. And it's pretty much the same thing like, first-class business seats on flights. You pay more for them, and the money made from that is basically used to subsidize the rest. So that was the argument of the governments. Yes, we will create these courts, but don't worry, the money we will make out of them will be poured into the rest of the courts. So many issues of inequality and justice only for businesses. That's why it eventually failed.
I want to come back to you now, Christine, because there is another part of the book which is also very interesting. This part mentions a speech that prosecutor Carla Del Ponte from the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia and also from the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda gave at a meeting at Goldman Sachs, one of the biggest banks in the world. During that meeting, she called their attention to the fact that international criminal justice is also in their interest. Can you tell us about the implications of these marketing practices and how they are entrenched in what is marketed as global justice?
Yeah, so the quote that you reference from Carla Del Ponte, where she goes to Goldman Sachs and says, invest in international criminal justice, is really indicative of the broader political economy of international justice. Also connecting somewhat to what Georgia has already said. So Carla Del Ponte goes to Goldman Sachs and says, invest in the ICTY, in the Tribunal for the Former Yugoslavia, because think about how little investment that is in comparison to US military spends, right? And the idea behind that is to say international criminal justice can have a stabilizing effect on governance structures. And when that happens, there is then no more need for military interventions by the US and all that money that has to be spent by the US military, because then the risk to investment is diminished through the stabilizing effect of international criminal justice. Now, I think that, and this quote by Carla Del Ponte is something that I return to again and again in the book, and was really part of the animating idea behind it to show that we think of international criminal law as separate from questions of foreign investment and so on, but they are entirely interlinked, and we know this because, as you say, Eduardo, judges, presidents will do fundraising and they go with this idea in mind that they are connected. So I think it would be an oversight for us not to try and understand that better, that connection better. And I do think it has a lot to do with what Georgia was already mentioning, suspicions of local justice systems. Now, in international criminal law, there's this concept of complementarity, which states that the International Criminal Court will only step in if local courts are unwilling or unable. But of course, there's much research that's been done showing that this is very much connected to, what in international legal history we understand as the civilizing mission. There is an idea that certain local justice systems are simply more civilized than others. And that does not just have cultural implications, that has implications on global capital flows, because that shows then that the states from the global north that are investing in states in the global south, they need to be protected from the risk that their capital investment could somehow be affected by local systems and including local justice systems. And I think that really connects George's work in the influx and the accumulation of these fora for protecting capital and connecting that to the role that law plays in doing that work of protecting foreign capital. Now, one of the key implications that I speak about in marketing global justice, and I think there are many to focus on, but I wanted to mention one in particular, and that is a re-entrenchment of the idea that the only political way of acting that we as individuals have is as consumers, right? It reinforces the idea that we are isolated, individualized entities that can only act as consumers. And there in the book, I was very much influenced by the work of Quinn Slobodian, who speaks about international economic law and investment law and the intellectual history connected to that as encasing the market, right, from any kind of democratic pushback. And I think we can really see that in the case of the two different ICCs we're looking at, the International Criminal Court and the International Commercial Courts here, in that these are institutions that are protected from any kind of democratic questioning. And the reason why they are protected is exactly because of this link between law and capital, because of the important function that these courts and tribunals have in creating safe spaces, havens for capital accumulation. And that connects to the cover of my book, where I chose this art collective that's been working on culture jamming and barcode art to show that barcode. So on the cover of my book, I've got a barcode, and then it has two sort of functions. One, we see the very familiar barcode, and then we also see those bars as literal prison bars. And the idea is to think about how we as consumers are imprisoned because we do not see our political subjectivity. And so the whole idea is to show that law is really very much implicated in that process.
Courts also play essential roles in establishing precedents and ensuring access to justice. How do the marketing practices we have been discussing so far affect these functions? I ask this because when I read of spectacle and visual campaigns, as highlighted by Christine, or in the case of Georgia, think about the strategy of linking international commercial courts to a particular city, such as Amsterdam as a hub for commercial dispute resolution, or even to a prominent judge, I begin to wonder about what such communication practices reveal about how these courts construct and exercise their authority.
There is this more immediate effect in the way we understand justice. For example, this emphasis on visibility, on transparency. And that, I think, comes more as a surprise to us who have a more civil law background, because in civil law systems, it's more the collective reputation of the judiciary instead of the individual reputation of different judges. So there we see that marketing encourages courts to become more visible. Justice must be seen to be done, but in a different sense of this phrase. And it enhances also transparency, which of course is a good thing. So the courts communicate their operations, they share more information, they publish data, which is of course a good thing. But this enhanced visibility does not necessarily always come, or it's not the same as publicity of court trials and judgments. Because as I mentioned, many of these courts, in an attempt to be attractive, they allow for confidential proceedings. So transparency, visibility is not synonymous to public access and publicity and the principle of open justice. But I think this more business-like mentality in civil justice, and because courts are increasingly becoming part of a very diversified dispute resolution landscape, they are just one out of the many options. You can mediate, you can arbitrate, you can litigate, you can litigate in your own country, abroad. So this diversification of dispute resolution and courts being just one out of many options creates also, I think, this diffusion of terms. in the words of Resnick. So we use transparency and we think that that's similar or synonymous to publicity, while it's not. The first is an organizational principle. The second is a due process right. It's two different things. So that's a more immediate effect on how it alters the courts and the way they exercise their authority, so to say. We see this increased turn towards treating court users as customers. So this increased emphasis on customer service, which we already mentioned, which also translate into more concrete rules in case law. It affects also jurisdiction, party autonomy, and so on. What we also see is a more functional approach to justice, which downplays territoriality. If you run like a business and you are trying to reach out to an international audience, then you should be able to hear disputes from everywhere. And not only that, we see, for example, that the Astana International Financial Center courts, they have premises abroad, conducting hearings abroad. Of course, what they claim is that this is just a hearing. But again, we see an incremental extraterritorial here operation of these courts. Or, for example, we see, I think this is even an even better example. I mentioned during the introduction that in 2024, Bahrain created the Bahrain International Commercial Court. Interestingly enough, they also signed a treaty with Singapore saying that appeals against decisions of the Bahraini court will be heard by an international committee comprised of judges in Singapore. So we have appeals from a Bahraini court being heard in Singapore by Singaporean judges and Bahraini judges, but abroad. So we see this branching out of justice. Can you create branches abroad? And I think this clashes with our more territorial understanding of justice and state sovereignty, which is very much linked to civil justice, so that we have this more functional approach. As the DIFC courts say in their strategic plan for 2024, justice not as a place, justice as a service, which means it's easier for it to cross borders. Yes. So this functional approach, but I think this also affects what you said, and now I'm maybe finally getting to your question about authority. What are these courts for? We think courts are in the name of the people. Okay, which people? Are the DFC courts for the people of the UAE who speak Arabic? And most probably not. What are the people of these courts? Are they for the international business community? So all these things of having foreign judges, having premises abroad, allowing lawyers to represent parties before the courts as an attempt to boost the caseload of these courts, they also come with legitimacy issues. Who are these courts for? Who do they represent? Who are the people? And again, here in a circular way, marketing can be used to manage and construct legitimacy.
Building on this idea that justice must not only be done, but also be seen to be done, Christine, there is another part of your book that I found particularly striking. You quote from the transcript of an International Criminal Court hearing where, at the very start, a photographer is present and the presiding judge pauses to allow time for the photographs to be taken before the hearing begins. What do you think that moment tells us about authority in international criminal justice?
Yeah, thanks for drawing attention to that episode, which is really indicative of how the International Criminal Court, and generally, I think international criminal courts and tribunals, have focused on image, which I think has had a huge impact on how we see their authority now. So I think it's a really great question. I'm going to expand it a little bit because I think what we see, again, you know, highlighting what's happening in Gaza, we see the failed promise of global justice and all these disciplines that were so keen to emphasize spectacle and to use spectacle, right? So international humanitarian law, international criminal law, human rights law, their link with the neoliberal aspects that were already available to them with this moralistic division between good and evil and so on, has now become a real problem. And in marketing, the question of overpromise is a real issue because that is how brands then fail and how the businesses fail. And we're looking somewhat, so this is why I'm going, you know, from your focus on courts, zooming out a little bit on the discipline of international law as a whole. We see the failure that has come with this overpromising of, you know, 30 years or so of institutions promising that they would deliver global justice. And now we see the streamlined genocide, and where the images of victims are seemingly making no difference on the ground, where the arrest warrants are making no difference on the ground. So we really see what happens with that overpromise. Now, part of spectacle is, of course, the enhanced and visceral attention in one particular place that takes place in an attention economy. But what has at the same time then failed to be spotlighted are exactly those kinds of processes that Georgia is talking about, right? So that's the sort of smooth working of international law in the background, no spectacle involved. And I think that really puts into context these, you know, you may have seen the Guardian article talking about the death of international law, and many op-eds and many international lawyers claiming that this is the death of international law. We see international humanitarian law being violated through various war crimes that are being committed by the IDF. And we see crimes against humanity, we see genocide and so on. And international law seemingly has no power to intervene, right? All these years of promising it would be able to intervene in a positive way, it doesn't seem to be doing that. And at the same time, I don't buy this idea that international law is on its deathbed, because I do think that there is a part of international law, and that's why George's research is so important, that does continue to work smoothly and strongly, where capital can continue to flow into that part of international lawyering, if you will, without great barriers.
Christine and Georgia, thank you so much for joining us and for such a great conversation.
And as always, thank you for listening to the Jurisdictions Podcast. If there's a specific international legal issue, concept or case that you, the listener, would like us to cover, please write to us at jurisdictions@asa.nl.